Yale Podcast Network.
Hello, and welcome to the Yale Law Journal Podcast. I'm Cody Poplin.
And I'm Emily Shire,
the show's co-host. We're very excited to bring you our second episode of Volume 128. Today, we'll be speaking with Professor Cynthia Esland about her new article, What Should We Do After Work? Automation and Employment Law. In this show, we discuss the threat that automation poses for the future of rights and benefits that have been constructed on the foundation of the employment relationship, and how to best protect workers' rights and entitlements in the face of that threat. Professor Esland is the Catherine A. Ryan Professor of Law at New York University School of Law. She teaches and writes about labor and employment law, including issues related to workplace governance, transnational labor regulations, and responses to labor unrest. Professor Esland, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for doing this.
Professor Esland, for years you've worked at the intersection of workers' rights and labor law. What led you to look at the impact of automation? Why focus on automation now?
Well, I'd say somewhere around 2015, the labor and employment world, especially on the law side, started obsessing about the Uber question. But Uber is sort of the tip of the iceberg. The issue of firms becoming increasingly willing and able to contract out their labor functions to firms or individuals who are either not covered or are somehow less bound by labor and employment law. And so I was going to a lot of conferences and thinking, well, let's not just worry about Uber's business model today. It's what we know to be their business model for the future. All of this may be a temporary phase on the way to, autonomous vehicles in the case of Uber. And in general, it seemed to me that people were focusing on a very real, very important set of problems that were in a way kind of an intermediate phase on the way to complete automation of many job functions. So that seemed to me not enough people were paying attention to that kind of end game. And that's where I decided to jump in.
That's great. So your piece explores how I think you identify four different aspects of the existing employment environment. First, the coming of automation, fishing, outsourcing, and how these new developments are interacting with existing legal entitlements and shaping the future of the American workforce. We want to unpack those a little bit and explore how they're working to magnify problems in the labor market. But perhaps we can walk through what you mean by each. So maybe just starting with, what exactly do you mean when we're talking about Uber and fishing in the labor market?
So fishing is the very brilliant term that Professor David Weil invented. It's kind of an umbrella term that captures many seemingly different ways of, as the economist would say, instead of making their labor needs by hiring people, they buy them from outside contractors. You could buy them from an independent contractor who's not covered by labor and employment law at all. That's the case with Uber. You could buy them from a Chinese manufacturer, which is not covered by American labor and employment law, obviously. You could buy them from a domestic contractor of some kind. And so fishery encompasses all of that. It's various ways of outsourcing or contracting out functions that used to be done inside the firm. So I always like to mention my dad used to work for the phone company. And when my dad worked for the phone company, it was the phone company. And the phone company employed its own janitors. Those janitors were part of a large production and maintenance bargaining unit represented by a union. And they were part of an internal labor market. And there were literally people who had made their way up, if not from the janitor's position, from, say, the mailroom. So that job progression up into the ranks of these large, capable, branded, relatively responsible and compliant firms, that's completely broken apart. There's barely a janitor in the country that's employed by a Fortune 500 company, unless it's a janitorial service company. So that growing tendency to contract out all the functions that can be separated out, it usually enables the firms to get those labor inputs cheaper.
Right.
For a whole bunch of reasons. But so it's become, and technology has made it easier to do that seamlessly, to get your labor needs without having to exercise traditional forms of supervision through these outside contractors. So that's a very pervasive phenomenon. It's reshaped the world of work. And it is a phenomenon that I feel is really important to take on board and to understand in coming to grips with the somewhat different but very related phenomenon of automation.
And so maybe you can tell us a little bit about exactly what you mean when you refer to automation and how it's related and also different from the problems of fishering that you're identifying.
Well, so automation is something that we are, there's a lot of attention to it right now, but obviously automation in the broadest sense has been going on since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. It is simply replacing human labor with machines. What's new and potentially different, although this is hotly debated, and I acknowledge that in the article, is that the types of things that machines and technology can do are expanding to include things that we thought were distinctly human. So machines' ability to carry on cognitive tasks of various kinds, complex, much, much more complex physical tasks, but most importantly, cognitive information processing, language processing, the sort of, if you think of human capabilities in the form of a pie chart, machines are sort of closing in on a very an ever increasing and high proportion of the things that humans can do.
So one thing that we wanted to get into is that in many ways, your piece is an argument that we are on the wrong track in terms of how we are responding to these issues. But as you brought up in your article and as you brought up in this interview already, some economists think that the current wave of automation anxiety amounts to, I think you called it, misguided scaremongering by modern day Luddites. And
yes.
I was hoping you could explain to some of our listeners in a little more depth why this wave of technological advancement in the workplace is different from what we've seen time and again before.
Well, as I say, this is a very active, vehement kind of debate that's taking place among economists and tech people. And I do not have the skills, the expertise to resolve it. So I try to lay it out there. It is hotly debated. There are those, the mainstream view among economists has traditionally been, and probably still is, trust in creative destruction. This has been going on for centuries in one way or another. And the economy, the market, and human needs are capable of creating jobs, responding to new human needs. So the technology itself creates some jobs, and we can easily foresee what some of those jobs might be, just interfacing with the technology. But it also frees up human labor and frees up resources by increasing the productivity of labor to create other, surplus income that can go into other products and services, some of which we can't even foresee. So this is a mostly a theoretical approach based. It's theoretical based on history. Of course, it is. If this time is really different in the nature of the technology, which the tech people especially tend to believe that it is, then history might not be our best guide. But I don't pretend to resolve that debate, but rather to say, first of all, this debate is. It's heated up, and it seems to me that there is lots of reason. There's both theoretical and empirical reasons that the economists are discovering to believe that this time might be different. How different? Will we be able to respond appropriately? Is there time? All these things are hotly contested. But start from the premise that we face an uncertain but significant prospect of significant net job losses going forward. What that means, the uncertainty means that we should do things that are going to work out for the better, you know, for the better for society, for the better for people, even if it turns out that that there is not going to be a great tsunami of job losses. So I think the sort of provisionality of the prescription needs to take into account the uncertainty of the prediction.
Right. So one of the things you suggest is that while a future that involves fewer working hours to some may sound utopic, it could actually be very detrimental, not just for labor, but for society overall, and especially so in the United States. I'm curious if maybe you could walk us through a little bit why automation might have a distinctly negative effect in the United States.
Well, I think we could imagine social arrangements that would spread a lower total amount of work in ways that most people would find extremely appealing. That is the kind of future that I think in Europe, people are well primed to think about. How can we, what set of policies will it take? And so in Europe, the proposals for reducing weekly hours, of course, they already have a much more robust package of vacations and leaves and all these other things. We have a lot more resistance to the idea that the government and the public policy need to exercise a heavy hand in shaping the future that we will have. We collectively, obviously, this is a very polarizing issue, but as compared, say, to the much of Europe, we tend to think that everything will work out as long as markets are functioning. And I think there's lots of reasons to believe that that's not going to be the case, that if we simply leave it to the market, we're going to have some highly in-demand workers working crazy hours and people at the bottom scrambling to work as many hours as they can, but a lot of polarization, a lot of mid-range jobs increasingly succumbing to automation. If we don't do something to spread work, income, and leisure in a more equitable way, it's going to be distributed in an extremely inequitable way.
Is this also tied to, I mean, you discussed the notion of an industrial citizenship, and I'm wondering if the potential, you know, negative effect here is tied to the unique way that the United States has tied social benefits to worker status.
Yes, that is, now I see what you're getting at. right. So although there's more variation than I really was aware of in how the various Western European countries fund healthcare, for example. But it is absolutely the case that starting back in World War II, we started taking a track of depending much, much more on employment as the foundation for some obviously essential entitlements like healthcare. There are very historically contingent reasons why we took that path, and it worked out sort of pretty much okay as long as the economy was roaring and expanding, as long as most people could look forward to full-time, long-term employment if that was the path they chose. But as that has become increasingly difficult, as we've seen the rise of contingent arrangements, part-time work, shorter job tenure, the gig economy, that starts looking increasingly untenable. So you're right to emphasize that point, that the way we've tended to center employment in the overall manner of delivering social benefits greatly exacerbates the concerns with both automation and fishing.
Now, one thing that I found especially interesting in your article is you explain how you can't really fully comprehend the automation threat without recognizing the larger underlying trend and reality that employing human beings is increasingly costly and risky compared to automation. And so I was wondering if you could discuss the inadvertent role that employment laws and labor rights advocacy is actually playing in providing motivation for automation and a general move away from human labor.
Well, this was kind of a very existential kind of crisis for me and for other people to realize that not just so separate human beings from employment law. Human beings are a mixed lot, right? And to hear this management consultant that I quote at some length talk about what a pain people are to manage, they're so demanding. They want attention. They want benefits. They want stroking. They want evaluations. And then sometimes they quit for no particular reason and you have to start over with someone new. Sometimes they are malicious. Sometimes they are misguided. They harass people. They cause you to get sued. Anyway, this litany of, and it was in rapid fire fashion. It was just literally, you could hear people's jaws hit the floor. All these people who have invested their entire professional career in workers and improving terms and conditions for workers. And here's this guy saying, managers are looking for every possible way to avoid hiring another single human being. Not that they'll never hire a single human being. Obviously, there are some things that's the only way to go. But if they can get a machine to do it, if they can get an outside contractor to do it, an independent contractor, the more they can insulate themselves from the foibles of human beings, the better. But as I went through that litany of, why people are a pain to manage and what the risks are, some of them you can hear have to do with labor and employment law. But, you know, it's a lot of the tangible burdens of labor and employment law are things that, like healthcare, as a matter of historical contingency, and we can call it fiscal convenience, is a burden that's been placed on employers. And only recently, under Obamacare, have employers been required to bear some of that burden. But there's no good reason to burden employers with the cost of their employees' health insurance if that sets up incentives. The incentives that it sets up are counterproductive in a world in which automation is an increasingly affordable and effective option for employers. So I honestly almost gave up on this project as I came to grips with this conclusion of mine, which people may also disagree with. But as I came up against this conclusion that, oh gosh, a national fight for 15, if you imagine doubling the minimum wage in all those parts of the country that are currently operating under the federal minimum wage, I've read as much of the evidence, hotly debated, evidence as I could, and could not avoid the conclusion. And I think even most very liberal economists can't avoid the conclusion that very large increases in the minimum wage, however much workers need that extra money, are likely to cause significant unemployment. And that is however great you think that threat is, however big the magnitude you think is likely to be, that is going to be exacerbated by the increasing availability of technology. That is kind of embodied in the burger flipping machines, robots that we know exist and that haven't proved to be worth it yet, but at some point they will be. And in the meantime, the technology is getting cheaper anyway.
If pushing for greater employee responsibility, such as like raising the minimum wage or other tactics, won't work, what is the solution for addressing automation, or at least maybe the way you put it, at least slowing down the pace of automation?
Right. So I do not want to be on record as coming out against efforts to improve workers' terms and conditions of employment. My argument is, and I'm not, that's not what you said, but my argument is that we have to separate the question of what workers' entitlements ought to be from the question of how to pay for those entitlements. So, for example, I think it's it's an international embarrassment that workers and, shall we say, humans do not have necessarily access to affordable health care in this country. It's still true. Obviously, people need health care. But the second step, how do we pay for that? Who should bear the cost of that? To the extent that we load that onto employers, that is a counterproductive increase in the the balance that employers, the calculus that they make, that distorts employers' demand for technology versus human labor. Step one, workers clearly need, I think it is important that workers have the ability to take a leave from their job for a decent period of time after having a new child to take care of themselves and their family members, and that they shouldn't have to sacrifice their income. So in other words, yes, paid leave is something that people should have. But if we put the cost of that on employers, that's going to increase, it just increases the tax on employment. There's no logical reason why employers should bear the cost of that paid leave. And when I say no logical reason, I mean the incentives that it sets up are counterproductive, especially in a world in which technology becomes an increasingly capable and cost-effective competitor with human labor. At the margin, that's going to tilt employers' decision against hiring that next person or even toward getting rid of some people.
One of the things I found really interesting about your piece is that you draw a distinction between the things that we shouldn't uncouple and the things that maybe we should think about because they are perverting the incentive structure of the workforce or leading to more automation or potentially could encourage more automation. So I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the rights and social benefits that you don't think should be uncoupled even in the face of this challenge.
Well, some easy examples are health and safety laws and the costs associated with workplace injuries and illnesses. Obviously, they're not as strong as they should be, in fact, but what they do is enforce employers to internalize costs that they can then hopefully arrange the workplace differently to minimize those costs. So I think when we decide what counts as decent work, and that's an obviously evolving, hopefully progressing kind of concept over time, depending on what we as a society can afford and what we sort of are changing social norms. If delivering that entitlement requires changing employer behavior in a particular way, then I think that's an illustration of a benefit or an entitlement that, even though it does have costs, should sit on the employer. So anti-discrimination law, to give the most obvious example perhaps. We, and to a great extent the rest of the world, through international labor standards, have decided that freedom from discrimination at work and in hiring and firing and treatment at work is part of the definition of a decent society and a decent job. Those laws have costs, no question about it, and those costs are a great part of what has driven employer practices in the right direction, I will say. You know, whether it has gone far enough, whether it has always, it's not an inevitable path of progress, but it has led to the elimination of at least most of the more egregious forms of discrimination. And that is largely because discrimination law imposes costs that employers want to avoid. They want to avoid by simply avoiding intentional wrongful behavior, intentional wrongful discrimination, but also by reconstructing their organizations to try to avoid less intentional forms of discrimination. So the costs, that is clearly part of what makes people a pain to manage, in the words of this management consultant that I quote. Both for example, the problem of coworker harassment and the whole compliance apparatus, the training, the grievance procedures, the supervisory training, all the things that firms have to do to try to avoid getting sued for discrimination. That is part of what firms calculate as to the risks and costs of hiring people. But I don't think there's any way that we could or should escape that those costs, because then we would not be putting the incentives where they belong. So the idea isn't, strip away all the entitlements that are costly. It's figure out which entitlements need to sit with employers and which ones can be put on a different funding base that allows for spreading and redistributing some resources, and also just reducing that quasi-tax on the hiring of human beings.
Your article discusses three other major trends that might be, shall we say, a little more familiar to people who might know less about automation. Growing economic inequality, we talk about that, we hear that in the news quite often. Erosion of labor standards, particularly at the bottom of the workforce. And then, you know, the issue of fissuring that we talked a little bit about before. And I was wondering if you could discuss how your proposed solution, which, you know, it might be more focused towards automation, interacts with and also addresses these three other major issues the market is dealing with.
Well, so I have this concept of the fortress of employment, the idea that we build up the entitlements associated with employment. And historically, labor advocates have tended to advocate for more, higher wages, higher benefits, more leaves, more paid leaves, more of everything. Some of that, I argue, doesn't have to be, and in fact, shouldn't be loaded on top of the employment relationship. It should be part of a more universal set of entitlements. So just to take the most obvious example, I think the sort of easiest example to use is healthcare. Health insurance under the Affordable Care Act is a pretty big ticket item. And especially for workers toward the bottom, it's a fairly significant share of the overall wage and benefit package. That is something that in many countries is completely detached from employment. Neither the cost nor the entitlement itself are attached to employment. Now, so imagine that you shift that and you go in the direction of a Canadian model or a UK model of healthcare so that everyone had the entitlement to decent healthcare and it wasn't paid for through employment. That would do several things. It would reduce the tax on employment. That's clearly one of the objectives here, but it would also reduce economic equality at a particularly, in a particularly important way. And it would create a stronger floor on the basic provision of social needs for people who either can't get into the fortress of employment, they can't get one of those decent full-time jobs, or they maybe even choose to take their chances in the gig economy. But this would help to put a floor under them so that people would have a greater freedom to choose a more high-risk entrepreneurial way of making their living, which is something that proselytizers for the sharing economy like to tout, but that in a society in which that we have no decent sort of social safety net, including healthcare, is a bit of a sham. It's doing all those things simultaneously, which is not to say, there's nothing easy about it, right? Politically, hugely challenging to sort of sell and press in the political process for this dramatically different way of thinking about where people should be deriving these fundamental benefits. But I think this is meant to be kind of a longer term vision of how we need to reshape an economy in a society that might soon face a kind of an erosion of employment as the foundation on which people can expect to make their livelihood.
So you frame your solution somewhat in terms of slowing down automation. I'm wondering if maybe you can touch on why the pace of automation matters. If it's inevitable, why should we be concerned about how quickly it comes online?
So first of all, I might want to tweak that characterization slightly. Slowing down automation, you could put it slightly differently by saying, let's not speed it up. Let's not contribute to the acceleration of automation. But why the speed of automation matters is because we face many different possible futures, but almost all of them require us to make some changes in how society is organized, and all of them require individuals to make rather important and sometimes time-consuming changes in their skill set. There's no question that there will be many good jobs for people with the right kind of skills, and getting to that skill set might require a very, very different system of education than what we have, for example. So if you look at the, I think, relatively rosy view of the McKinsey Global Institute account, they prescribe a long list of social, political, and economic reforms, and reforms in the educational and training system, for example. And it's going to take time. It's going to take time to do all those things. So the dislocation will be greater, and the chances of reaching one of the more palatable futures will be greater if we don't, if the job destruction part doesn't happen too fast. So there's a job destruction part and there's a job creation part. And if we slow down the job destruction part, there's the better chance that both the job creation part and the other social changes that will need to be in place will be able to keep pace. So that's the basic pitch.
You know, one of the things that is a theme throughout your article is how important a role work plays in, you know, all societies, but especially American society, in part because it fulfills, you know, a very strong social value. And I was wondering if you could talk a bit about how we can potentially deal with that void if automation eventually replaces a certain and large segment of workers, even if we can handle the unburdening of legal entitlements.
So I think that is one very important reason why we should be looking to, number one, spread the work that remains by giving people more access to time off, for example. So this is actually taps into the next phase of this project. But so we, people who are working 30 hours versus 40 hours are going to do just fine, right? It's people who end up unemployed entirely. And that people who have capabilities that they could bring to society that are end up unemployed altogether, that's just a total social political failing that we could remedy if we can get our act together. But there's also, you know, part of the answer, familiar though it may be, is public investments in creation of jobs, doing things that we all know need to be done and that people are still capable of doing, but that require public investments because they're either a pure public good, like lots of infrastructure, for example, or they simply involve care services and other services to people who can't afford those services on the market. So there's lots of there are a lot of unmet social and societal and individual needs that we should be investing in. And so public job creation has to be part of the solution, in my view, because I do believe very strongly that we should be trying to look toward a future in which, you know, the vast majority of people are part of the workforce that is doing work, meeting market and social and other kinds of needs engaged in cooperative, participatory projects. I do tend to romanticize work, so I don't want to say let's not romanticize. I do tend to romanticize work, but you know, even I have my first book in 2003 actually was about the sort of social integrative function of work, and that participation in the paid workforce is the single best set of institutional mechanisms we have for bringing people in regular cooperative contact with people they don't otherwise perhaps choose to spend time with. So that is something that, for example, if we look toward the two major ideas that are getting a lot of airplay for how to deal with a world of less work, one is the universal basic income, which looks to replace, to some extent, to replace work with income. And the other is the federal job guarantee. Unfortunately, I think those two are mutually exclusive for both fiscal and deeper reasons than that. I think there are some problems on both sides, but as between the two, I think the value that work has for individuals and for communities and for the society should tilt us much more strongly toward, if not a federal job guarantee, toward the idea of creating work opportunities by investing in unmet social needs.
Great. You may disagree with this characterization, so if so, just let me know. But one of the things I found particularly fascinating about your article is that you offer proposals that could be categorized as maybe traditionally conservative in some cases, so such as removing certain employer obligations like healthcare and family paid family medical leave. But then you couple them with what I would characterize as traditionally progressive solutions, like moving closer to a universal single-payer healthcare model. I'm wondering, how has that been received?
I would say... No, it's an interesting question. At one point I say in the article, just because Andy Pusder says it doesn't mean it's not true. Andy Pusder famously complained about the $15 an hour minimum wage because, you know, if you make people more expensive and machines are cheaper, it's not rocket science. The point is, yes, I think we have to sort of have a reality check on how employers are likely to respond to a significant increase in the cost of labor. And so I think that's probably been a bit of a sub-theme in a lot of my work all along, although my sympathies definitely lie with the sort of workers and workers' organizations and the needs of people on the bottom. My beliefs about how the world works sometimes are a little bit closer to the economists than some of my colleagues. Why I think people need to open their minds to that is because it isn't the end of the world. It doesn't mean that we have to abandon workers, that we have to give up on protecting the basic entitlements and terms and conditions and the idea of decent work and progressive objectives. We just have to focus on finding ways to finance those things that does not have the unfortunate side effect of destroying more jobs faster.
This is switching gears a little bit, but I was fascinated that you've done quite a lot of research and scholarship on China. And I was wondering, how, if at all, the work that you've done looking at Chinese labor law and employment law has impacted your study of automation and more generally how automation might affect the American workforce.
In facing this crisis of potential significant job losses, we had a really good run of industrialization. We have a lot of wealth that was developed and a lot of institutions that were developed over the phase of industrialization, in which the mechanism that social wealth was distributed to workers in the form of wages, and that together with a lot of very hard organizing work by labor unions and a lot of hard political work, resulted for a good part of the 20th century in a pretty good distribution, or at least much better than what we have now and what we had before. China is, well, China is luckier than the countries behind it on the industrialization train, let's say. But they are facing a more serious problem. So on the one hand, they feel compelled to invest very heavily. They're like among the biggest investors in robots in the world, because they see that as their competitive advantage. Their competitive advantage used to be cheap labor. That's not their competitive advantage anymore. And so they are investing very heavily in robots, but they're doing so with a great deal of anxiety because they realize that unless they find ways to expand the labor market in other spheres, they are potentially destroying the engine that has driven much of the growth and prosperity that they've gotten so far. There's lots of problems with China. I have many concerns, especially in the last several years, with their increasing turn toward repression. But what they do have is a long time horizon and a sort of policy apparatus that at this point, you can't help but look slightly enviously at a system that can actually think through problems in 10-year, 20-year timeframe and try to figure out and actually put into place what's needed. I'm not giving up on democracy, but our political capacity right now to make the kinds of big reforms and changes and investments that I think are needed is really in sorry shape right now.
There was actually a question that I really wanted to ask you about, is what you thought the potential political appetite for this kind of reform would be. There was a major political candidate for president of the United States, former candidate, who I heard speak a couple of months ago, and he actually talked a lot about this automation issue and made a very similar point to the one you just made, that our politics doesn't seem to be set up to address the kind of looming crisis that could be on the horizon. You touched on this a little bit. I do wonder, how do you think this will all play out? Do you think there's any way to kind of build any kind of political consensus on addressing these issues, even if it's not necessarily the exact reform proposed in your article? But is there any how do you think this might end up playing out?
Well, I would just say that right now, with unemployment being at historic lows, it's a little hard to generate any consensus that this is actually a problem that we face. I think that the politics will change, although I can't say they'll necessarily change in a good way, but they could change in a good way if we start seeing, if you start getting a growing consensus, say, among labor economists, that, oh, turns out this time actually is different. We are seeing massively greater polarization and destruction of decent jobs in the middle, and a sort of lower net demand for human labor. This is a real problem. But I think it's going to have to come home to people. If people, let's say, people my age or younger who have any kind of, you know, even incremental political weight in policymaking, start to conclude that their children cannot reasonably be expected to actually make their living at a decent job, that is no longer a viable expectation, I think you'll see a different kind of debate. The other thing that will come home, and the question is just whether it comes home too late, is to the extent that the prescriptions are, a lot of the expectations of those who say this time is different are expectations of polarization, of an increasing pulling apart of people with in-demand skills or resources that they've accumulated by owning, you know, the technology, which is going to be hugely productive on the one hand, and people who have nothing but the kind of ordinary human skills that people have been relying on for all of human history to make their living. Those, that second group of people are going to be in increasingly difficult shape competing for what might be a shrinking set of jobs. If that starts, we first start seeing that, you're going to get some kind of uprising. I think that, you know, people, that kind of mass immiseration and growing inequality is going to end up bubbling up in one form or another in ways that's going to make this society a harder place to be. I think the people who have the power, who are sitting happy at the top, relatively happy with their own situation, are going to have to come to grips with a world. Do they want to live in a world in which a large part of the population is a sort of ticking bomb, or, you know, very resentful and rebellious? Are they going to be satisfied to build private enclaves of comfort and privilege, and that will just like wall out the rest of the population? I'm making it sound very apocalyptic, but the point is, if that's what you see coming down the road, a kind of bifurcated world in which some people get into the, you know, into the fortress, and some people are just left outside. First of all, one thing is clear, is that does not look anything like a democracy. And there's, I think there are some scenarios that are pretty scary on that front. But it's also not a world that I think many thinking people want to live in, even if they and their own children are taken care of. And so that will have to count on people sort of managing to come together in the face of some, you know, scary prospects.
The article is "What Should We Do After Work? Automation and Employment Law." Professor Eslin, thank you so much for joining us.
The Yale Law Journal podcast is a production of the Yale Law Journal. Thanks again to Ryan McAvoy and the wonderful folks at Yale Broadcast Studio for making this production possible. If you like the show, don't forget to share it and give us a rating on wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, thanks for listening.